speaker today is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy, a former jet fighter pilot, and a combat veteran with 74 successful missions over Vietnam. In addition, he helped start the Top Gun School in Miramar, California. On his 75th mission, just 5 days before he was scheduled to return home, Captain Plum was shot down over enemy territory. He ejected from his F-4 Phantom jet, parachuted into enemy hands, was taken prisoner, tortured, and survived nearly 6 years in communist prison camps. He has returned to share his story of winning through adversity to more than 4,500 audiences in this country and around the world. To get a better feel for what this man went through, let's watch this video.
The first prison cell I was in Vietnam was 8 feet long and 8 feet wide. I remember distinctly the dimension of that little cell. I could pace 3 steps in one direction before I ran into a wall. Then I had the opportunity of turning around and pacing 3 steps the other way. Inside my new little home, I had nothing to do, no books to read, no windows to look out, no TV, telephone, didn't have a pencil or a piece of paper. For 2,103 days, age 24 to age 30, I'm describing this scenario to you somewhat semi-dramatically because I think the most value I can be to you, professionally and personally, whether you come here from Austin or Amsterdam, whether you're a mother or a father, or whether your goal in life is to change the world or to change a diaper, the most value I can be in your life, professionally and personally, in the few minutes we have together, is to invite you into my little prison cell. You see, there's a great deal to be learned here. Now, the first thing you learn in a prison cell is pain. You learn a lot about pain. Second thing, you might not suspect this. Second thing you learn in a prison cell is, well, the minutes eventually wear into hours. The hours eventually wear into days and days into weeks and weeks into... You acclimate. You get used to this. In fact, you get so comfortable in your little 8 foot by 8 foot prison cell that the last place you want to go is outside the cell because it's dark and lonely out here. At least you know the devil in the 8x8. Here's what happens. This restriction gets built up. And the restriction is not the 8 feet between the walls. Turns out the restriction is the 8 inches between your ears. You're in a mental box. This is a mental game. Want to find phenomenal freedom? It's not breaking down those walls, it's breaking down these walls. That mental myopia that we all get in the challenges that we face. It didn't take me very many miles. I was going nuts. I finally decided, Charlie, if you're going to survive this, you're going to have to come up with something to do, make a little game to play. I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll make a little deck of cards, and I did. I constructed a little deck of playing cards about the size of postage stamps. I tore these cards from 52 little strips of toilet paper. And I can verify this from that experience. Toilet paper is tough to shuffle. You don't lick your fingers very much shuffling toilet paper. Okay, before we get back into the prison scene, now there's a connection between my life story and yours. And while I hope and pray that none of you will ever be in a prison situation like this, you'll have some of those same kinds of challenges. And you're saying, wait a minute, Charlie, you know, I mean, what could be worse than nearly 6 years in prison camps? Well, here's the connect, okay? Here's the touch point. Here perhaps is a reason that your life and mine met on the 19th of May of 2023. I keep thinking, every time I say 19 May, I think 67, because that's when I was shot down. Here's the connection. Here's the touch point. Here perhaps is the reason that your life and mine intersected today. You see, there's not a person in this ballroom who has not, in the last few weeks or months, felt lonely, felt unattached, had trouble communicating, even with those you love the most, as I did. Not a person here who hasn't felt a little shame when you didn't accomplish your mission, as I did. And so, if in fact there's a connection, the next question is easy. Well, okay, how do you break free from that prison? How do you attain that phenomenal freedom that we all have physically, but maybe not emotionally? Well, you do it by packing parachutes. Let me explain that. Several years after I came home from Vietnam, I was in a restaurant in Kansas City where I used to live. About two tables over, a guy kept looking at me. I got his eye, but I didn't recognize this gentleman. He stood up. The guy walked over to my table, and he pointed at me with a very stern look on his face. He said, "You're Captain Plum." I looked up, and I said, "Yes, sir, I'm Captain Plum." "You're that guy. You flew jet fighters in Vietnam. You're a fighter pilot. Part of that Top Gun outfit. You were shot down off the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk. You parachuted in enemy hands, and you spent 6 years as a prisoner of war." Somewhat dumbfounded, I looked up at this guy and I said, "How in the world did you ever know all that?" He finally broke into a smile and he said, "Because I packed your parachute." Tell you this, for this guy that runs around the country making speeches, suddenly I was speechless. Best I could do was stagger to my feet, reach out a very grateful hand of thanks. He came up with just the proper words. The guy grabbed my hand, he pumped my arm, and he said, "I guess it worked." I said, "Yes, sir, indeed it did. And I must tell you, I've said a lot of prayers of thanks for your nimble fingers, but I had no idea I'd ever had the opportunity of expressing my gratitude in person." He said, "Were all the panels there?" I said, "I must be honest with you, they weren't. Of the 18 panels I was supposed to have in that parachute, had 15 good ones. Three of the panels were torn, but it wasn't your fault, it was mine. I ejected from that F-4 Phantom jet at 600 miles an hour close to the ground. That was well outside the envelope of that parachute. You did your job, I didn't do mine. I said, but let me ask you a question. Do you keep track of all the parachutes you pack? Do you know of all the lives you've saved? Guy said, no. Now, this is the most important part of the conversation that night. Maybe the most important thing I say to you this afternoon, think it deals directly with what we're here to do. I think it deals directly with the inner circle. I think it deals directly with the challenge that you and I have as Americans, and as business owners, and as mothers and fathers and brothers and Christians. Here's what he said. He said, now, I don't keep track of all the parachutes I pack. It's enough gratification for me just to know that I've served. Here's a sailor, okay? An enlisted guy well below the waterline of this aircraft carrier. His job is to stand at a long wooden table, and he weaves the shrouds, and he folds the silk panels of these parachutes, and he passes them along 8, 10, 12 hours a day while the jet jockey, while the top gun zooms around the sky at the speed of sound. Couldn't have cared less about the guy down there in the hole. Until one day my parachute came along, and he packed mine up for me. It all boils down to parachute packing. It all boils down to serving without asking anything in return. So question becomes, gang, how's your parachute packing coming along? Who is it that looks to you for strength in time of need? Just as important is, how's your parachute packed? Who packed it? And have you thanked them lately? Mine was pretty well packed. My physical parachute, 15 of 18, okay? My mental parachute had the skills of my craft. Fighter pilot, naval officer, engineer, pretty well educated guy. And I knew how to fly airplanes. My emotional parachute, pretty stable guy. My spiritual parachute, I knew the Lord. Got my parachute packed early in life, just like you did. Grew up in a tiny town in Kansas. The Compton, Kansas, town of some 325 souls and a couple of Presbyterians. I couldn't say that unless I was one, right? But I was a rich kid. One of those top percentile people we're all looking to do business with, right? Oh, I didn't have any money. I didn't have indoor plumbing until I was 7 years old. But we were rich in family unity and love and had a great childhood. But I grew up in a three-room house, three rooms. Not three bedrooms, three rooms total. In fact, I shared the only bedroom with my big sister and my two little brothers. In fact, I never slept alone until I got married. So, some of you aren't laughing at that. I was a 4-H'er and a Boy Scout, and I threw the newspaper in that little town. Great childhood. Got my parachute packed. Of course, Mom, Dad, my mother, Mother Teresa, I would put her right... As long as I lived with my mother, I never heard her say anything negative about anybody. She taught me forgiveness. I found that forgiveness is more than just a Christian principle. I found that forgiveness is a survival principle in a prison camp. My dad was a World War II disciplinarian. Tough guy, tough guy. Learned a lot from him, too. How to work hard, how to focus, how to stay involved. And the other people in that little town, you know, the preachers and the teachers and the coach, I'll never forget the name Smith. If Clarence Smith were still alive, I would have called him this morning from Houston to thank that guy for packing my parachute. Thank him for giving me some of those nuggets I was going to need when the going got tough. This is ragtag basketball. We lost and lost. Last game of the season, we lost again. Imagine one dejected 13-year-old lad wandering off to the locker room. Here comes the coach. He was a veteran. He had shrapnel in his leg from his war, and he walked with a limp. But he caught up with me, and I felt his arm over my sweaty shoulder. And I looked at the coach, tough, disciplinarian. All I could think of to say was, "I'm sorry, coach. I guess this team's just a bunch of losers." The coach squeezed my shoulder. He sunk his fingernails into the flesh. He was about to say something he didn't want me to forget. He said, "Son, whether you think you're a loser or whether you think you're a winner, you're right." I didn't understand what that meant. I asked him, "Coach, what did that mean?" He said, "Just this." He said, "Life is a choice. Every day of your life is going to be another beautiful choice. I don't care where you go. I don't care what kind of a scrape you get yourself into someday." I don't know how he had that kind of premonition, unless it was the way I played basketball. He said, "You can choose every day. You can choose a smile or a frown. You can choose happiness or sadness. You can choose profit or loss. You can choose health or sickness. You can choose life or death." He said, "Now there is one more choice. When the going is tough and the margins are thin and you're all out of ideas and nobody's on your case and you want to quit, you can always choose to give away all those other choices. You can absolutely elect to step back and become the victim, or you can step forward and become the victor. It's your choice." With that kind of inspiration and motivation, as you might suspect, I graduated from the little grade school top of my class of two. And the other guy wasn't all bright. I don't know how smart you were at age 17. I'd never seen the ocean at age 17. Never ridden in an airplane. I used to see him go over and wondered if I'd ever be able to ride in an airplane someday. Never been out of the four states of Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri. I was a hayseed from Kansas. What I didn't know was I need an education. Now, my parents couldn't afford to send me to college, so I started looking for scholarships. Just did the old shotgun approach. Got an appointment to Annapolis, the Naval Academy. Had no idea what they did at Annapolis. But I got on that Greyhound bus, and 2 days later, as all you veterans in the room have done, I pledged to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I had no earthly idea what it was going to take to fulfill that commitment. I learned a lot there at the boat school. Learned to tie knots, send the Morse code, drive the ships around the Chesapeake Bay. Lucky for me, I got my parachute packed. Don't miss the metaphor. Parachute packing is not a trade, okay? It's, "I'm going to do this for you if you'll do that for me." That's not it. Parachute packing is a gift. It's unconditional. I keep thinking about Zig. I got to tell you about Zig. He's one of my mentors. And I keep thinking, I have used this quote as for the last 50 years. You can have everything in life you want if you just help enough other people get what they want. See, this is the service thing. It's a secret. It's a secret, but it's magical. That if you give unconditionally, you can have wonderful things happen in your life. It just works that way. So at the Naval Academy, we had parachute packers, officers, chaplains, midshipmen, and the superintendent, Admiral Charles Kirkpatrick. This guy would stand up in front of the big pep rallies before those football games. The guy would clench his fist. You could see the veins running his brow. He would say, "You guys can do anything you set your minds to do." "You guys can do anything you set your..." Was this hype? Messing with our minds? Mental manipulation? Did it work? Those 4 years, the Naval Academy took a ragtag football team and produced two Heisman Trophy winners, Roger Staubach, Joe Bellino. I was lucky enough to see both those guys play. We were the number one college team in the nation for a while. Best of all, Navy beat Army 4 times straight. This guy was right. Interesting stories there, Captain. What's it got to do with being in business anyway? What's it got to do with the circle? What's the point here? Just this. I was empowered by both those guys. Both the coach and the superintendent empowered me. They empowered me to win, which was wonderful, but more importantly, they empowered me to fail. Did you get that part? Life is a choice. You can do anything you set your mind to do. Those are positive or negative. You can take those either way. They empowered me to win. They empowered me to fail. Most importantly, they empowered me to make my choice between the two. And so it is in your business. Look what you've got. Look at the opportunity. Just like Santiago said, man, you won the lottery just to be in business in this country. Look at the opportunity. Okay, look at the technology. Look at the network. Now look at this outfit. Look at Howard and the gang, okay? Look at all the things that are happening in these 3 days that you're here. You're empowered in every way to go out and win. More importantly, you are empowered to fail. Didn't want to hear that. Nobody does. Because what do you and I want out of life anyway? Well, Captain, how about giving me cradle to grave? You know, I want all gain and no pain, please. And if you can't do that, just minimum give me a level playing field. Make it fair. Oh, we've watched Make It Fair. We haven't understood all that much. We've watched Make It Fair. Okay? The old Soviet Union is a good, great example. You know, chicken in every pot, car in every garage. And there's a kid down your block, I hope not in your family, raised with a silver spoon, never allowed to stub his toe. They don't keep score in his soccer games, and now he's into drugs. And everybody's saying, wait a minute, he had everything. We made it fair. Here's the advice. Anybody offers to make it fair? Turn, run. It ain't fair. Never will be. Your success will be what you make of it. Not what's around you, that's for sure. In fact, I'm convinced that it's not what's around you that makes success or failure in your business. It's the choices you make about what's around you. And you can win and you can fail and you can give away that choice. So with that motivation and inspiration from the Admiral, I graduated from Annapolis. And from that school, well, I didn't graduate top of my class. In fact, from the Naval Academy, I graduated in half of the class that made the top half possible. Dirty job. I threw that hat in the air, pinned on those officer bars. What a proud day in my life when I married my high school sweetheart, lovely blonde girl from Kansas, under the Arch of Swords. It was a military wedding. Flight training, Pensacola, Florida, Beeville, Texas, Meridian, Mississippi, where John McCain was my flight instructor. John taught me to fly jets. Out to San Diego, where I flew the first adversarial flights for the Top Gun school. Have you seen Top Gun? Oh, great movie, huh? I didn't see the second Top Gun, the Top Gun Maverick. I didn't see it for about a month. And I got this call from a fellow fighter pilot, Charlie. Have you seen Top Gun? No, I haven't seen it yet. Well, I have. I got to tell you that you'll probably cry. My son calls up and said, Dad, have you seen Top Gun yet? No, Joe, I haven't seen it yet. Well, I saw it, and you'll probably have an erection. And my wife says, probably at the same time. No, it was a great movie. Great movie. I got to fly with the Blue Angels in November for my 80th birthday. What exciting times. Yeah, really cool. So there I was on the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk in San Diego, 24 years old and in command of a multi-gazillion dollar jet fighter. See this hand? I have two throttles in this hand. I shove these throttles into the afterburner so I can go 1,400 miles an hour, and that's a long way from the old John Deere. See this finger? Pull the trigger on my control stick. I can release the missiles from underneath my wings, and I can knock down enemy airplanes I can't even see. I really am the top man. Can anybody deny this? I am the best of the best. I'm the guy that always stands tall. I'm the one that's never afraid. Hey, I'm probably bulletproof. How about it? You ever feel bulletproof? Pretty easy in business, you know, when you got money coming in. Pretty easy before COVID, right? When everything was going well, right? You didn't have any restrictions, huh? Pretty easy to feel bulletproof before that divorce or the cancer in your family or that best salesman you ever had decides to go to your competition. See, here's the advice. It's okay to have positive attitudes. I totally believe that that glass in front of you is half full. It's not half empty. But when you start getting cocky, when you start believing, you know, that that somebody else owes you a living, okay? When you start believing that somebody else can pay your bills, when you start believing that you're bulletproof, here's the advice. Check your 6 o'clock position. You got a missile back there sneaking up your tail. We were hit. SAM, surface-to-air missile, exploded some 12,000 pounds of jet fuel, sent that bird topsy-turvy, end over end down towards the rice paddy below. I ejected, my co-pilot ejected, our parachutes opened, and we came floating down over enemy territory. Ever been in one of those parachutes? I don't mean the nylon ones, I'm talking about the parachutes of life. That's what this discussion is all about. The little offender benders that you and I get ourselves into once in a while. I'm talking about something as insignificant as being cut out of your lane on the highway, something as major as the loss of a child. But really, isn't that where your value lies? I mean, let's try to measure it, okay? I mean, just for fun, let's measure the value of you. What are you worth? What are you worth to your company? What are you worth to your family? What are you worth to your God? You see, it can't be measured in easy times. Anybody can show up. Notice that? Anybody can log on. Anybody can fill out the form. Okay? Anybody can read the script. Your value has to be measured when the heat's on, when things are tough. Your value shows up when you don't know the answer and you're confused and you're frustrated. Your value shows up when you want to quit. And your spouse wants you to quit. Or let's turn the coin over. Let's play what if. What if you had the perfect world? What if everybody said yes to all your great ideas? Would you be as good as you are today? Would you be as proactive? Would you get up as early? Would you work as hard? Would you dress as neat? Would we even have a meeting like this if you had no challenges? Here's the point. Hang in there. You're not going to believe this one. There's great value in getting blown out of the sky once in a while. There's great value in that wake-up call that you and I want to roll over and ignore that forces us to re-examine the way we're doing business. Anybody have one of those wake-up calls lately? Yeah. If you hadn't had one of those wake-up calls lately, they're probably coming because that's what this is all about. Those moments when you get blown out of the sky, how do you handle that? Well, I don't know how you handle it. All I can tell you is how I handled it. Felt the opening shock of the parachute. As I had been trained to do as a fighter pilot, I immediately looked up and counted the panels in my parachute. That technique is called assessing your support group. I looked out at the unknown. They're shooting at me. The audacity of this enemy. Don't they know I'm the top gun? Haven't they read the papers? Don't they know about me? Look, they've just knocked down my multi-gazillion dollar jet fighter. Now they're shooting at the pilot. And I'll tell you this. Now you can identify with this one. When you're dodging bullets, it's tough to come up with a long-range plan. So how do you handle it? I don't know. What happened? Felt the opening shock of parachute. Okay, I took a deep breath. I let about half of it out as that old gunny sergeant taught me on the rifle range, calm yourself, you know, before you pull the trigger. Deep breath, half of it out, bowed my head, and I said a prayer. I sort of stopped the world for a moment to talk to God. I'll never forget that prayer. I thought about that prayer a lot over those next nearly 6 years in those various prison cells that I was in. I would think back to that moment when I'm hanging in the tie. I would say to myself, well, dummy, why didn't you make a deal with God? Promise to be a righteous, sober, godly guy the rest of my life. And Lord, all I need from you is a little wind. 10, 12 knots, gusting to 40, please. I guess I didn't feel him in that much of a negotiable position, so I just prayed for the guts it was going to take to survive. I recognized that there was going to be some pain in my future, and I prayed that there might be some value in the pain. And I prayed for my wife. Remember her? Lady I married under the arch of swords. See, this was my war, not hers. And yet, at the end of the war, she would have more pain from that war than I did. I'm talking, you know, I was talking a little bit ago about thanking the vet, okay? Thank the vet's families. Those guys and gals many times have a tougher time than the vets. So I hit the ground with the mud. Talk about waist deep in a rice paddy. Descended upon by, it seemed like, 1,000 of the enemy. Stripped me of everything I had. Flight gear, clothing, personal possessions. They even took my name. They gave me a name from their language to humiliate me for the next nearly 6 years. Dragged me around village to village, camp to camp. Tortured for 2 days with ropes and irons and whips. And finally, into this little cell. The one I described to you from the very beginning wasn't kidding you an inch. Let me tell you about my state and about the first several months I was there. Okay? First of all, I was bleeding from 4 open wounds. No medical care, 4 open wounds, 4 holes in my body where blood's coming out. I had boils all over me. We never really understood, but the guys that were shot down in the summertime just got covered with these carbuncles, big, ugly, pussy boils. I was surviving on 2 bowls of rice a day and some broth, if you were lucky. I'm down to maybe 120 pounds, I figured. I'm rotting away in this communist prison camp, and in my physical state, and that, ladies and gentlemen, was the good news. The bad news was my mental state. I'd given up. I had surrendered. Fighter pilots are not supposed to surrender. That's not in the Top Gun playbook. I had surrendered. I felt very guilty about that. You guys and gals have been in the military know the code of conduct, okay? It says if you're a prisoner, you're only obliged to give name, rank, serial number, date of birth, those 4 things. I flew the skies of Vietnam convinced I'm tough enough. I will never give more than name, rank, serial number, date of birth. But the pain was too great. And I felt very ashamed about that. How can I go back home and admit to my family, to my fellow fighter pilots, that I had failed so miserably in my mission? And so maybe I won't go home. You know, maybe if this war ever ends, I'll go to some foreign country and change my name and just try to forget how weak I was. So I'm pacing along with this guilt and shame and frustration. And I heard in the far corner the chirping noise of a cricket. I'd been a farm kid, knew what a cricket sounded like. Yet the longer I listened, the more rhythmic the chirp became. I walked over to investigate this cricket sound, and I found there no cricket, but a little piece of wire was about that long. Poked through a hole at the base of the cell wall, scratching on my concrete floor, making this chirping noise. Are you with me? Can you imagine what might be going through your mind in a situation like this? My first thought, can't be the enemy. They're not sophisticated enough to try to trick me. If it's not the enemy, it's got to be another prisoner. If it's another prisoner, it also has to be a fighter pilot, like me, since Jesus is in these prison camps. Ooh, and I'd like to talk to another fighter pilot. Could we tell some stories? But I bet that guy's tougher than I am. I mean, I don't know who he is, but he's probably stronger. probably older, probably a better fighter pilot. He probably didn't spill his guts to the enemy like I did. I'm losing interest now. Ever feel that way? You know, with that customer that wasn't too happy with our delivery, with that employee, you know, that's causing us a lot of trouble that we don't even want to talk to, that the spouse, we have those unspeakable problems. And maybe I'll just crawl over in the corner of this prison cell and wait. You know, surely in a few years, a Marine will break down the gates and I'll be set free. I'll never have to take another risk the rest of my life. Oh, there's an interesting principle, R-I-S-K, risk. We try to avoid risk, right? Oh, we teach our children to avoid risk. We have ways to measure risk tolerance, and so we try to avoid that in most everything we do. I'm here to tell you that if you're gonna be success in your business, you're gonna be success in life, you have to take a risk. You have to kick down what's left of your comfort zone sometime, get further outside yourself, go tug on a wire. Now, this is not easily done. I sweated bullets, okay, for hours before I got up the guts to take this risk. I finally did it. Reached down, grabbed that wire, said a little prayer that I was doing things right, and I tugged on the wire. And the wire tugged back, and I tugged again. And it disappeared right back through that rat hole. Whew. I didn't know what was going to happen now. The wire came back about an hour later. This time the wire had a note wrapped around the end of it. The note was written on a dirty piece of toilet paper. Just blobs on this watered up piece of toilet paper. I could barely make it out. But it said, memorize this code. Then eat this note. I did it. I memorized that. The code is a 5x5 box of the alphabet, okay? Five lines, five rows. A, B, C, D, E is the first line, F, G, H, I, J. We left out K to make it come out even. Numbers down the side, across the top, indicating any letter, would be represented by two numbers, number of the line and the number of the row. Got it? A, first line, first row, one tug, one more tug. Z, fifth line, fifth. You think your email is cumbersome. You try this. But it worked. It worked. This silly, cumbersome, archaic code became our language. More than that, it became our lifeblood. It was absolutely vital. I mean life and death vital that we communicate with the other prisoners in that camp. Oh, and here's the interesting part. It wasn't the words. Wasn't the sentences. It wasn't the top secret escape plans we were passing around. That was not the importance of the communication. The importance of communication in a prison camp and in your company is the simple validation of another human being. In those prison cells when it was dark and you were alone, some guys were in solitary confinement for 4.5 years. If it was dark and you were alone, you'd lose track. You wouldn't know what's a memory, what's a hallucination. Sometimes you wondered if you were even alive or dead. The simple tugging on a wire and to have that wire tugged back. Revolutionary. It was for joy. It meant two things. Number one, I'm alive. Somebody's responding to something I'm doing physically. Thus, I exist. Number two, somebody cares. How does that fit in your world? You see, it's the old adage, another one of Zig's lines, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's not just with your customers. That's with your people. That's with your family. That's with your neighbors. You have to validate folks. And it works. It works. On the other end of the wire, Lieutenant Commander Bob Shoemaker, fighter pilot extraordinaire. He'd been there for over 2 years when I showed up. He was there for over 8 years in the prison camp. I'll see Bob next week, as a matter of fact. This is the 50th anniversary of our homecoming. We came home in 1973. Wednesday of next week, the 24th of May, exactly 50 years to the day, Nixon gave us the biggest meal the White House has ever served to date. It's a record. The White House had never served a bigger meal than it did on the 24th of May of 1973 to the returning POWs.
Welcome home.
Oh, thank you. That never gets old. Thanks. We're replicating that meal next Wednesday night in the Nixon Library in Yuma Linda, California. And they've got a ballroom, matter of fact, a little bit bigger than this room, that's made just like the West Wing of the White House. They are going to serve us with the same china and the same centerpiece and the same silver that we ate 50 years ago. And they're telling us they're going to serve the same food, which wasn't all that good. But it'll be great to see the guys and Bob Shoemaker, because the guy saved my life. He said, "How you doing, Charlie?" Or Plumber. That was my coat side. You know, it could have been Maverick. Plumber. He said, "How you doing, Plumber?" I said, "I'm doing terrible, Shoe." He said, "My president sent me over here. It's this dirty Vietnam War. It's all political. We know that. It's not my fault. I'm just a victim of circumstances beyond my control." And the enemy is not playing fair. They're torturing prisoners. They signed the Geneva Convention. They're not abiding by it. It's not fair what's going on in my life, and it's not my fault. I'm the victim of circumstances beyond my control. And it was not my private airplane I flew in, you know. That was a U.S. government airplane, said so right on the side. Congress bought it. I didn't. They should be here. I should not. Whole thing's not fair. What's going on in my life? Ever feel that way? But it's not my fault. I guess we all do. I'm just a victim of circumstance beyond my Shoemaker said. You want to know your biggest problem? I said, "You mean I have problems bigger than the ones I can see?" He said, "Sounds like you're suffering from a fairly common prison disease. Most fighter pilots get this disease when they're shot down. Some guys die from it if they don't get it cured." Oh, man, what's the name of this disease? He said, "Well, around here, we just call it prison thinking." I said, "Prison thinking?" He said, "Roger, you think you're a prisoner." I stepped away from the corner of that prison cell. A little more self-analysis, okay? I'm still bleeding from 4 open wounds. This is months without medical care, okay? Those boils, I have so many boils on my front side, I can't count them all. So many on my face, I can't see through them. I figure I'm down 115 pounds. My sole possession in life is a rag I have knotted around my waist to hide my nudity. Clearly, I'm rotting away in a communist prison camp. And now, to add insult to injury, they put me next to a positive thinker. I kept talking. "All right, tell me about this prison thinking." Don't you see? When a fighter pilot is first blown out of the sky, or when any of us go through a little wrinkle in the plan, what's the first emotion? "Oh, God, why me? This is so terrible. This time in my life, the best it will ever be is a period I can someday forget. We'll never have any value. There's no value in this pain. But it's not my fault." "Oh," he said, "there's your problem." I said, "What's that?" He said, "You will find in this prison camp or in life, when you start blaming everybody else for the problems of your life, you give away control of your life." That's what the coach was telling me. Remember the coach? Said I had the option to give away the option. Shoemaker says precisely how to do it. Here's the catch, gang. Business owners, leaders. Here's the catch. Sometimes it's not your fault. Okay? Sometimes it is COVID. Sometimes it is the weather. Sometimes it is the market. Sometimes it is the government. Sometimes it's not your fault. Next question. What do you get when it's not your fault, but you're blaming other people and giving away control of your life? I said, okay, I guess I got a bad case of this prison thinking stuff. What's the antidote to my disease? He said, well, first of all, you got to be a believer. I said, okay, I'm a believer. I said, I accepted Christ as my Savior when I was 13 at a camp in Kansas. He said, well, it's more than that. You got to believe in the flag. You got to believe in our country. You got to believe in the team that's gathered here. You got to believe in yourself. You got to be a believer. I said, okay, I'm a believer. He said, you have to have courage. We're facing every day. It's the bottom of the ninth. We're 20 runs behind, and you're going to swing the bat believing that you're going to win the game. Okay? He said, you have to have humor. I said, wait a minute. Humor in a prison camp? He said, that's right. You will find that it's a whole lot healthier to laugh at things than it is to cry at things. Okay? Think about those things. He said, you will find, plumber, that you've just joined the best team you'll ever play on, bar none. You'll never play on a better team than we have here. You will find this is the best leadership you will ever see, bar none, the rest of your life. You will never see better leadership than we've got in this prison camp. Our American military officers in this camp can't see us. They can't hear us. They can't text us. They can't email us. They can't fire us. They can't give us a bonus. They can't do any of these things, and yet they are the best leaders you'll ever see. They're setting the example. They've given us a purpose in life. They're telling us that we're not on the defensive. I said, wait a minute, Chu. I'm not on the defensive. Look at me. You are not on the defensive. You are a warrior. We will pursue this war to our last dying breath. So pull up your big boy pants. We've got a war to fight. Whew. Did that turn things around? Just giving us a focus, a direction, a purpose? Well, here's the results of all of that. A study that was done about 5 years ago, of all of the combatants of Vietnam, 30.6% had PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. You heard about it in Camp Hope. PTSD, right? A third. Of the prisoners of war, 4% of the prisoners of war have PTSD. And it's primarily the guy shot down near the end of the war were not tortured, were only prisoners for a few weeks or a month or two. And they're the ones that have the psychological problems. Figure that out. Well, the psychiatrists and psychologists and the folks that know a whole lot more about this than I do say it was because of the leadership that we had in that prison camp and the team that our leaders put together that had a purpose. Leaders, give your people a purpose. Make it a big one. Make it that 100 million, you know, that Tommy was talking about. Make it a big old goal. Because we all need that. So I'm involved in several organizations like Camp Hope. What it's called Boulder Crest, and that's what we try to do, is rehabilitate guys with PTSD and guys that are suicidal, okay? And we're working on it, and it works pretty well. And we're doing better than the VA, as a matter of fact. And I have become a poster boy for Boulder Crest and PTG, post-traumatic growth. Look that one up. The whole idea that you can come through a situation like I've been through or like you've been through and come out better and stronger and healthier and more alert and more positive and more confident to meet the next problem. It's not new. It's not new. Look at Nelson Mandela. Look at Mother Teresa. Look at Jesus Christ. It's not new. Embrace the challenges that you face. Because I'm convinced adversity is a horrible thing to waste. That, how do you waste adversity? Well, you start out by blaming everybody else for your problem, okay? And then you feel sorry for yourself. Get a big bushel, you know, of pity and wallow in it for a while. Poor Mama Plums, little boy Charlie, long way from home in a communist prison camp. That's the way you give away the value of adversity. So Shoemaker sure saved my life again, and I'll thank him again next week when I see him at Nixon's library. But he wasn't the only one. In fact, some of the best parachute packers in the camp turned out to be the lowest ranking guys there. Maybe the best was a Navy sailor. Got a couple of Navy sailors in the crowd. A white hat. An enlisted guy. Okay? We were all officers, of course. We were fighter pilots. We were college graduates. Okay? And it took a Navy sailor to come aboard and show us a thing or two about leadership. It was an air war, right? Over North Vietnam, right? How did a sailor get into a prison camp in an air war over North Vietnam? Well, he fell off his ship. He used to tell us, I wasn't captured. I was rescued. Depends on how you look at it. 19 years old, Seaman Douglas Hegdal from Clark, South Dakota, was on the fantail of the cruiser Canberra in the middle of the night. Ship burps, he falls off. Could he take a joke? We'd have these contests just for something to do, while away the time, you know, and as fighter pilots do, and we would tug on wires and tap on walls on our secret code and pass around a questionnaire. Who's the oldest in this prison camp? Who's got the most kids back home? Who's been here the longest? One time we had what we call the high fast, low slow contest, to try to determine what fighter pilot had jumped out of his jet going highest and fastest, who jumped out going lowest and slowest. Well, high-fast contest is won by some Air Force jock who punched out of his F-105 at 52,000 feet, 1,000 miles an hour, and the low-slow contest is won by the Navy sailor. 12 feet at 15 knots. Oh, but here's the interesting part. And why I take your valuable time to tell you his story. This insignificant entry-level, new hire, part-timer, young kid. You know who I'm talking about, right? The folks that you and I have to rub elbows with, but usually they're more trouble than they're worth. The sailor didn't seem to suffer from this 8-inch box. He did not have a bad case of this disease called prison thinking. What did the sailor do? Like all good sailors, he set to work. He got into action. He made something happen. He decided, as bad as this looks, there's some value here, and I'm going to find it. He kicked down what was left of his comfort zone, got further outside himself, and started taking risks. Okay, tugging on wires and tapping on walls and communicating with all the prison. He began by memorizing our names, 254 names in that camp. Put those names into songs. He would sing these songs over and over and over till he finally got all 254. But he wasn't nearly finished. Went back through the list. He memorized our social security number or identifier. 254 different long numbers. Unbelievable. Still wasn't finished. Went back through his list. He memorized our hometowns all across the country. Then our next of kin, wives and fathers. Finally, I'm not kidding you, the sailor memorized the telephone numbers of each of the relatives of each of the prisoners. Unbelievable. Now, about that time in the war, an interesting thing was happening, which hasn't really been, a story hasn't been told, but is about to be told. Our wives were back here petitioning our government and governments around the world to put pressure on the enemy, stop torturing my husband. Kissinger, in his memoirs, say there was a real thorn in his side because they were out there making international policy instead of Kissinger, because they were going to all the embassies and consulates all over the world. They sold little silver bracelets with our name on them. So some of you folks might remember those silver bracelets. You had bracelets, to support their activity, and it worked. About that time, the torture stopped for the most part because the enemy finally realized how important we were because of our wives were back here telling the world we were. And so the torture stopped, and they decide, okay, what we're going to do, the enemy says, we're going to send some guys home early before the end of the war. First guy they went to was John McCain. At the time, his father was CINCPAC, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific, 4-star admiral. McCain's dad was in charge of the Vietnam War while John and I were prisoners. Amazing. So they decided to go to John. And McCain, get your stuff together. We're going to go to the airport. You're going to go home before the end of the war. McCain said, in your dreams, I'm going home before the end of the war. I wouldn't embarrass my father by doing that. I wouldn't give up on these other prisoners of war, my buddies that need American medical aid more than I. You take your idea and shove it. And he got beat up pretty good and put in solitary confinement for another 2 years because he refused to go home. So they're still looking for someone. So our senior man sent the message to the sailor. Son, I want you to go home first. The sailor sent back, sir, with all due respect, I would rather stay here with the team. I want to march home with you guys. I want to be a part of the solution. Our senior man sent back, that's not an option, sailor. Here's a direct order. Shove off. Sailor said, aye, aye, sir. Home he came. Now write the script on the sailor. What would you expect, okay? The guy's 21. He's been in prison for 2 years. He's been starved, humiliated, lonely, tortured, hadn't seen a woman in 2 years, and suddenly he's free on the streets of San Diego with a brand new suit of clothes on and 2 years back pay in his pocket. Oh, did I tell you he was a parachute packer? Well, what do you suppose he did? Sure, he started to travel, went west coast to east, he went north to south, spent his own money and his own time going through each one of those hometowns, dialing each one of those telephone numbers, speaking to each one of the wives, tell her that her husband was alive. I'll tell him of your applause next week when I see him. But the question is this, okay? You know those folks I'm talking about? Those parachute packers? People that qualify, that they give without asking anything in return, they serve, all right? Well, look to your right, look to your left. We've got a room full of them. That's what this is all about, is parachute packing. And they're not just here, okay? We've got a support group at home. We've got families, and we've got friends, and we've got neighbors, and we've got folks in our church. Boy, I thought I'd buy my wife a lot. I would fast forward my mind about every day, spend about an hour a day thinking about what I was going to do when I got home. I'd plan the next 20 years around her, and when I wasn't home, I did it again in a different way. And in a third way, I had three different options I was going to present to her when I came home as how we were going to live the next 20 years of our lives, the kids we'd have, the duty stations, the places we'd go, the vacations we'd have. Didn't quite work out that way. The war finally ended, okay? Here's how it happened. I'd wondered for years how we would find out we were going home, and then how would we react? You know, a bunch of old, bearded, crusty guys, would we cheer when we found out we were going home? Would we cry? Would we hug and kiss everybody around us? Here's how it happened. In came the rat, the camp commander. The guy in charge of all of our torture. He was a rat. He looked like a rat. He opened the cell door. There were several of us in that little cell. Wider than ever been opened before, and he announced, "The war is over. We are trading prisoners. Get your stuff together and get on the bus. It's outside the gate." Nobody moved. Nobody cried. Nobody hugged and kissed anybody else. I kept waiting and wondering, what's happening here? Finally, our senior guy, Lieutenant Commander Jim Peary from 8 Mile, Alabama, stood up, and as we had been forced to do all those years, he made a very low, ceremonious bow to the camp commander, and then he squared his jaw, and he said, "Sir, we're not going home until all the sick, injured, and enlisted men have left this camp." And he was serious. And the camp commander couldn't believe it. The rat said, "Wait a minute, Peary. I'm offering you your freedom." I'll never forget Peary's words. They ring in my ears like this was yesterday. He stood there and faced the camp commander and said, "Sir, freedom is vital to us, but not without our integrity." Well, the rat did not understand that piece. Hauled Perry out of there, put him in a stockade, beat him up pretty good, and came back to the rest of us. And he said, "Your senior guy, Perry, has just gone crazy. The rest of you will not be penalized if you'll get on the bus." Well, we didn't know what to do. Okay, a bunch of junior officers there, left without much information. What do you do when you don't know what to do? Have a meeting, right? That what we all do. You know what we decided? First of all, nobody's going to believe this. This is so preposterous. Try to explain this to our moms when we get home, to our wives, families, that we gave away a free ticket. But we just can't go. We can't even make a legitimate argument for the decision we're making. It's just, we can't go. So I stood up and I faced the rat and I did him a low bow and I said, "Sir, just prove to us that the sick, injured, and enlisted men have gone. Then it will be our turn, not before." And you know, of the nearly 7 years I was in theater, and as many bullets as I dodged, and as close to death as I came, that was the scariest moment of all, facing up to this guy that had that had my life in his fist. And was I happy when he turned and sped out of there and slammed that cell door closed. But he came back about an hour later with a printout, a computerized sheet, a manifest, the plane load of guys, the first plane. And it was our prayer list. The sick, injured, and enlisted among us. They'd gone. Now it was our turn. Still no rush for the bus. They put Jim Peary, our senior guy, back with us. He called us to attention outside that cell, and he called cadence up 2, 3, 4 as we marched out of there, proud Americans with our heads held high going home. Over the dike, from the top of the dike, we could see the runway, the enemy's runway. On the end of the runway, a United States Air Force C-141 cargo jet ready to wing us away to freedom. What a sight that was. Lump in my throat, flag on the tail. Still no response. Nobody cried. Nobody cheered. Nobody hugged and kissed anybody else. You know, it wasn't until we climbed aboard that airplane. It wasn't until we rolled down the runway. It wasn't really till we finally lifted off enemy soil. We all broke loose and started hugging and kissing the Air Force nurses. Ninety minutes later, I was putting these feet on free soil, Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. Ran down the ladder and crossed the tarmac to the first telephone I could find to call. You would have too. Had that conversation, that first conversation memorized. I knew every word. I knew the emphasis on every syllable. But she was gone. So I called my folks back in Kansas. What has happened to my wife? My father was so broken up, he couldn't talk to me. Mom finally said, "Son, I'd give 10 years of my life if I didn't have to tell you this," and I'm sure she would have. Your wife hung on for 5 years, then just 3 months ago, she filed for divorce. She's engaged to be married to another guy. Whew, what a gut punch. So I spent the next 2 weeks at Great Lakes Naval Hospital in Chicago. Kind of crawled up in a fetal position in a bed, feeling sorry for myself and blaming everybody else for the problems and getting into this pity party. Wait a minute, Charlie, did you learn nothing in that little 8-foot by 8-foot classroom? Do you not recognize that you've been able to overcome a major challenge in your life? Come on, man. Tuck in your gut. Pull up your socks. Let's get on with life. And so I did. And so did the other guys, too, the other prisoners of war. 591 of us came home. 591, they thought we'd be in baskets. They thought we'd be vegetables. They had our families briefed to institutionalize us for the rest of our lives. They thought they'd put us in a funny farm. So far, from 591 men, we have produced 17 generals and 7 admirals. Most of us retired as senior grade military officers. We went back to flying airplanes, as I did, and commanding ships, as I did. We went back to commanding corporations and and trade associations, and we have doctors now, and lawyers, and preachers, and teachers, and bishops, and judges, and two ambassadors from our number. We have a bunch of congressmen, two United States senators from our number, a vice presidential candidate, and a presidential candidate from 591 men. And just, and we're setting records, just kind of amazing. How we have all gone through this thing, and we've come back like we've come back. Shoemaker on the end of the wire. He just retired as a two-star admiral. Guy in my back seat. Came back to the States, went back to flying Navy jets off aircraft carriers. Some guys never learn. My ex-wife married the guy she was engaged to. They're living happily ever after, and we remarried a wonderful gal from Texas, as a matter of fact, and we have four kids and four grandkids and have lived a very happy life. So shortly after I came home, 50 years ago, I ran into this character. I got to tell you, quite honestly, the first time I saw Zig Ziglar, and I know that many of you knew him or know of him or have seen videos, and I know that Howard talks a lot about Zig Ziglar. I don't know how you felt the first time, but the first time I said, this guy is—he's bigger than life, man. He's over the top, and I'm not sure I can really trust what he's saying. And we were doing—I've been on the stage with him many times, and we were doing one of these public seminars with 5,000 people in a stadium in Minneapolis. And I knew he was going to be up there, and I'd known him by then. And he calls me up, Charlie, you mind, we're getting to Minneapolis about the same time, would you mind if we share a cab to the hotel? Or actually, I've got somebody picking me up. Okay, so that'd be fine. I said, but, my flight's about an hour after yours. You're going to have to wait for me. Oh, that's okay, it's okay. So this lady picks us up. She's running the program. And I find out that Zig has this deal with the redhead, his wife, that he's never in a car or alone. Do you know that about Zig? Yeah, he's never in a car alone with a woman. And he always wants another person in that car with him. And I thought, man, that's really walking your walk for sure. And at the time, I was training for a marathon. And if you've listened to his tapes, he talks about, when he was fat and decides he's going to get tripped, and he starts running. He runs to a mailbox. He says, I got a mailbox, and then I ran two mailboxes. And he talks about how successful he is as a runner. Okay, and I'm training to run this marathon. And I'm probably at least 30, probably 35 years younger than this guy, okay? And then I wonder, let's let him put his... put his body through that kind of thing. Can he really run like he says he can run? And so I challenged Zig Ziglar to jog. Hey, let's go jogging, Zig. Oh, yeah, let's go jogging. We started running, and we ran, and we ran, and he ran, and he ran. The guy beat me by a mile. So he's the real deal. And if you want to pattern your life after Zig Ziglar, you would have a very successful life. And the stuff that he says, see at the top, that's pretty much. And I look forward to the time I can see Zig Ziglar again, because he's a mainstay. And I did run a marathon in Alaska. I chose this marathon in Anchorage, Alaska, because it's called the Midnight Sun Run. It's the Saturday closest to the longest day of the year. And I chose that one because I figure I might need 24 hours of daylight to run 26 miles. Took two of my kids up there. Joe and Emmy went with me. And but the night before the race, okay, I'm at the hotel talking to the kids. Kids, this is your dad's craziness, and I don't want to impose on your vacation. It's an early go for me. I don't even know where this race is, but I'll find it. Don't worry. You guys take it easy. Sleep in. I'll be back tomorrow afternoon. Boy, it was a hot day for Anchorage. I had not trained for the hills. I'm making excuses now because about mile 13, I hit the wall. Man, I'm just barely putting one foot in front of the other, sweating like crazy, thinking to myself, the most beautiful sight in the world is going to be that finish sign, but it wasn't. It was under the fence. He said, here's Joe, Evie, two of my kids, cheering on the old man. When I finally caught my breath, I said, you just don't know how much it means to your father to have you here, but how did you find the finish line? Oh, well, Dad, we shared a cab with a couple of guys from the hotel. They knew where it was. Well, how did they know where it was? Well, Dad, they ran the race. They came back to the hotel. They had breakfast. Said I ran it. I didn't win it. Okay, I've spent an hour of your very valuable time telling you sea stories. And I hope and pray that none of you will ever face that 8-foot box. But you will face the 8-inchers, you know. That's what this is all about. So how do you gain this phenomenal freedom that we're talking about here? How do you bust down those walls anyway? Because that's more restrictive, I'm convinced, than the walls that kept me locked up for that long time. Well, I'm convinced if you can, you know, follow the lead of this guy, and if you can put together Howard's principles of success, and if you can kick down those walls, you know, get outside that comfort zone, if you can take a risk, if you can tug on wires, if you can pack parachutes, I'm convinced you can do anything you set your mind to do. Great being with you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You're very kind. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.